Chapter 27. Cabrillo's hope for a long bath following his return to the Oregon was not meant to be. He allowed himself a quick shower only after all the prisoners had been made as comfortable as possible in the hold. He had been introduced to Libya's ex-foreign minister by Fadl, who'd been his deputy. As it was nearing noon, Juan had shown him in which direction Mecca lay relative to the ship so they could all pray for the first time since their incarceration. He was dressing when Max Hanley knocked on his cabin door and entered without waiting. In tow were Eric Stone and Mark Murphy, who still wore his filthy uniform. On seeing Cabrillo, he said, "Man, that is totally not fair." "Privilege of rank," Juan replied airily, and finished tying a pair of black combat boots. "What do you have for me?" "They apparently bought the trick with the sinking rail car," Max said. "They sent out a chopper to investigate about 15 minutes after you boarded. Mark's time estimation of its sinking was spot on. They must have seen it seconds before it went under." Eric cut in. "Then I swung the UAV back over the terrorist camp. Because of the altitude I had to maintain so they wouldn't hear it, the camera's resolution wasn't the best, but we have a pretty good idea of what was happening." "And?" "You were right," Max replied. "The flight of Libyan military choppers landed with no opposition. It looks like there were only a few men aboard any of them."
"Sounds like transport back out to me," Juan guessed.
"That's our read, too," Eric replied. "They're going to be moving more men than they can carry in that old MI-8 you flew on from the crash scene."
"What's the capacity of the choppers?"
50 at least."
"Hell of an assault force."
Mark said, "The target has to be the peace conference." Eric Stone shook his head.
"Never happen. The security is impenetrable. There is no way a terrorist is going to get within a mile of a single dignitary."
"They would, if the Libyan government's in on it," Max countered.
"That's the million-dollar question.
If Minister Ghami is Suleiman al-Jama, does Gaddafi know it?"
"How could he not? He appointed him."
"Okay. Say he does, Max.
That still doesn't mean he knows what al-Jama is planning."
"What difference does it make?" Hanley asked.
"Maybe none, but it's something we need to know."
"And how do we find out?"
"I'll get to that in a minute.
Mark, is there any chance we can take out those choppers?"
"We'd need to launch another UAV," Eric said before Mark could answer. "The first drone's out of fuel and I had to ditch it. Though not before taking this."
He handed Juan a grainy still photograph from the drone's video camera. Details were murky to say the least, but it looked like two armed men escorting a third person toward one of the helicopters.
"Is that Secretary Katamura?"
"Possibly. Factoring the height of a typical Libyan male and comparing the middle figure to them, the height is right, and the build certainly fits. The person's head is covered so we can't see hair, which would have been a dead giveaway. Hers flows to the middle of her back."
"Best guess?"
"It's her. And by the time we turn around, she's going to be long gone." Juan frowned. He'd made a conscious decision to save the Libyan prisoners rather than wait out the terrorists. The balance of one life versus 100 tipped the same way no matter who sat on the scales. But being so close and not getting her irked.
"Okay.
What about taking out the other choppers?" he said to get the meeting back on course, his eyes lingering on the picture.
"We could laze them from the second UAV so I can guarantee a missile hit, but we have to consider collateral damage if Secretary Katamura's there."
"Options?"
"Nail the choppers in flight if they come out over the ocean. But again, we risk her life if she's a hostage aboard one of them."
"They'll stick to the desert anyway," Eric said. Max cleared his throat.
"Listen, why not pass on what we know to Overholt and let him tell the other delegates about the possibility of a massive attack?"
"We'll tell Lang," Juan replied, "but I don't want that information disseminated."
"Why the hell not?"
"Two reasons. One, if they know the attack is coming,
They will call off the conference, and the chance to get these people in a room talking peace again is zilch. The conference has to proceed. Second, we have nothing concrete linking Ghami to Aljama. This is our one and only chance to expose him and his entire operation. You're risking a lot of important lives.
Mine, for one, Mark said. I admit it's the biggest toss of the dice we've ever attempted, but I know it's worth it.
Overholt will agree. He understands that if we can nail Aljama on the eve of the peace conference, it will give it such a boost that the delegates are certain to hammer out a comprehensive and lasting treaty. In one blow, we take out the second most wanted terrorist on the planet and guarantee lasting peace.
Boy, Juan, I'm not sure. The prize is awesome, yes. But the price, you know.
Trust me. Still uncertain, but never one to doubt the chairman, Max asked,
"So how is this going to work?"
In a minute, he turned his attention to Murph and Stoney. "What did you two come up with?"
"There's not a whole lot out there that doesn't fall into the realm of fantasy."
"Hold it," Max interrupted. "What did you have them research?"
"Alana said there might be something called the Jewel of Jerusalem stashed in the original Suleiman al-Jama's tomb. She was told about it by St. Julian Perlmutter. Even he wasn't sure what it was. What did you guys find?"
"You haven't given us much time on this, so our report is sketchy at best. There are two schools of thought. Well, three, if you include the vast majority of scholars who think the whole thing is baloney. Anyway, one school says the jewel is a cabochon ruby about the size of a softball with some words carved into it. People believe it may be Surah 115 from the Quran, a final chapter to the Muslim holy book that appears nowhere else because Muhammad believed it so perfect and so special that it could only be written on a flawless jewel."
"Any idea what it says?" Juan asked.
"Depends on which side of the radical line you stand. The nutjobs think it says they should kill infidels all the livelong day. Moderates ascribe to the idea that it promotes peace between Islam and Christianity."
"So no one knows."
"Exactly," Mark said skeptically. "Take any object, give it the ability to bring special knowledge or power, and voila, you've got yourself a legend that'll last for generations. Kind of like the Ark of the Covenant. Total bunko, but people still look for it today."
"Skip the commentary and stick to the story."
"Okay. They say that Saladin first brought the jewel to Jerusalem following his siege of the city in 1187, and that the stone was kept in a cedar box in a cave beneath the Dome of the Rock. The legend says that any man who dared gaze upon the stone went blind or mad or both."
"Convenient, huh?"
"So the stone sits in its underground vault until the Sixth Crusade in 1228. During this one, Frederick II of the Holy Roman Empire made a treaty with the ruler of Egypt that turned over control of all of Jerusalem to the Christians, except the Dome of the Rock and the nearby Al-Aqsa Mosque. It was during this period that German mercenaries working for the Knights Templar stormed the dome and stole the jewel."
"Why would Christian knights want an Islamic relic?"
"Because they thought it was something else. Remember, I said there were two schools of thought. This is where their paths cross. You see, the Templars believed the Jewel of Jerusalem wasn't a ruby at all. They thought it was a pendant fashioned 1,000 years earlier for a man named Didymus, or Judas Talma."
"Never heard of him," Max grumbled.
Eric said, "You know him better as Doubting Thomas, one of Christ's 12 apostles."
"And this pendant?" Juan prompted.
"As you know, in the Bible story, Thomas didn't believe Christ's resurrection and demanded to touch the wound. The Bible doesn't say whether he did or didn't touch him, but the Templars were convinced that he did. They believed the Jewel of Jerusalem was a crystal into which an alchemist called Jochabe had encapsulated the traces of blood left on Thomas's fingers.
The crystal was then hung from a necklace that fell into Muslim control when Saladin took the city.
If that were true, wouldn't the Muslims have destroyed it? Hanley asked.
Actually, no, Eric replied. By all accounts, Saladin treated the city's Christians and their churches respectfully. He might not have given back the pendant, but I doubt he would have intentionally destroyed it either.
So now the jewel, either a ruby or a necklace, is in the hands of the Templars. How does it end up entombed with Suleiman al-Jama?
Because the ship carrying them back to Malta
is attacked by Barbary pirates. Juan answered his own question.
One of Aljama's ancestors, in fact, Eric said. The cedar chest with the jewel inside gets passed from father to son until Aljama's death. Henry Lafayette left it in the tomb, and so it sits today.
It's all crap, Mark spat. Chairman, if you saw some of the websites where we found this stuff, you'd know there's nothing to it. It's a myth, like the Loch Ness Monster, or Bigfoot, or the Lost Dutchman Mine.
There was a kernel of truth behind the myth of Noah's Ark, if you recall from our little adventure a few months ago. The chairman went quiet for a moment. We know for a fact from Lafayette that in his later years Aljama saw there was hope of peace between Christians and Muslims. This has only recently come to light, right? It isn't something conspiracy buffs are privy to.
Here's a little speculation. What if the first version of the story's right, about the jewel being an inscribed ruby, and Aljama read Muhammad's last words, and that led to his change of heart? It does lend a little credence, yes?
Possibly. But come on, what are the chances it ends up in Aljama's possession?
Why not?
He was a noted imam from a family with a long history of piracy. Even if one of his ancestors wasn't part of the attack on the Templar ship, it's still possible the jewel was given to them as a tribute.
Gentlemen, let's get back on course, Max suggested. At this stage in the game, it doesn't really matter what the jewel is or even where it is. Our focus should be on saving the secretary and stopping Aljama's attack.
Max, you said something about how the Libyans are claiming our old buddy at the harbor, Tariq Assad, is Aljama.
Obviously a smokescreen, if we're right.
Has Eddie reported anything that makes you think Assad's involved with Aljama's faction?
No, but this morning they noted Assad's house and his office are surrounded by covert agents. The Libyans are making good on their promise to nab him.
And when the dust settles, they'll have their scapegoat, Eric remarked.
They'll put on a quick show trial and execute him for the attack.
The Libyans have to be targeting him for a reason. There must be something to this guy, right?
Max, get on the horn and tell Eddie to pick up Assad. We need to question him.
Cabrillo studied Mark Murphy for a moment. Murph's jaw was blurred with stubble, and he slouched in his chair as if he were melted into it, but his eyes were still bright. In the past few months, after a lot of ribbing from the crew, he had embarked on the first exercise program of his life. He'd been through a lot in the past 48 hours, yet Juan suspected he was ready for more.
You up for another op?
I still want that shower first, but yeah.
I want you and Eric over the border into Tunisia to find Aljama's tomb.
Cabrillo didn't like losing his best helmsman at a time like this, but Murph and Stone worked together on such a deep, intuitive level that he felt it necessary to send both.
Better take along a couple of gun dogs, Max suggested. Don't forget the Tangos kidnapped the fourth member of Alana Shepherd's team.
Bumford, Mark said. Emil Bumford.
Linda and Link say he's a tool.
Just so you know what you're up against, Hanley continued, the other archaeologists report that there were at least a dozen terrorists who snatched him.
Gomez can chopper you over and be back in a couple of hours.
We still have fuel left in the cache we set up in the desert when we first talked to Bumford.
Good. I want you guys in the air in 2 hours.
For now, all I want you to do is find the tomb. If they've beaten you there, stick close and watch. No matter what, don't engage them.
Greg Chaffee's volunteered to fully debrief the prisoners, but from what I've been able to gather from them so far, Aljama wants that tomb as badly as we do. His entire operation out in the desert was an attempt to find it. Be ready for anything. Ready is my middle name.
Herbert's your middle name, Eric teased.
It's better than Boniface.
Cabrillo's phone rang. It was the duty officer in the op center.
Chairman, I thought you'd want to know. Radar picked up a low-flying aircraft parallel to the coast near the approximate position of the terrorist training camp.
Could you track it?
Not really. It popped up only for a second and then vanished again. My guess is it's flying at wavetop height.
Did you get its speed or bearing?
Nothing. Just the blip, and then it was gone.
Okay. Thanks.
He set the Bakelite handset back on its cradle.
Aljama's men are bugging out.
Max glanced at his watch.
Didn't take them long.
I'd like to think our little fracas pushed their deadline, Juan said, but I doubt that's the case. He went quiet for a moment.
What the hell were they doing near the coast?
The chopper. Why risk getting close to the coast where they could be spotted?
Eric's right. They should stick to the empty desert.
Max, I want you to do a search on Libya's naval forces. I want to know where every ship capable of landing a helicopter is right now.
Hanley asked, What about you?
I'm going to call Langston and convince him to stick to my script. Then I want Doc Huxley to look at where I gouged out my subdermal transmitter and give me another dose of local. I have a feeling I'm going to need it.